No, as there's only a few of us, probably go to the questions probably reasonably quickly. So there probably is less public address in it. But most of my works, in fact all of my works, really primarily deal with an exhibition as a period of time that has kind of experiences for the viewers or attendees or whatever in a kind of primary sense. So that the work is focused on experiences in that space in that amount of time. This work in particular, although it does look and probably does indicate me as like an artist that crosses over into music a lot, is not really the case in the wider part of my practice. I guess this is more of a work for musicians in an art gallery space, in a gallery context. It's not so much, and I think hopefully how it installs takes away maybe from how it's described in words, it sort of sounds like it's a kind of orgiastic kind of almost like ejaculatory explosion of light and music and rock stadium and everything like that. But hopefully the way in which it's installed actually takes it away from that a little bit, and it becomes more of a kind of channeling or seance to move from one type of existence to another kind of existence. So the music kind of plugs into the light of the room, which is its kind of its perceptual architecture, which gives it this kind of movement and liquidity in terms of the experience whilst you're actually in the space. I think in probably more than, say, being influenced by, although very much I enjoy the music of avant-garde guitarists, I'm far more influenced in my practice by conceptual artists and the kind of alchemy of reducing one thing to language or that kind of material magic of something being in kind of conversion. I'll probably go to questions now. I could probably go on like that for quite a long time, but there's probably a bit more structure if people want to ask questions about how and why and where.
One of the really lovely things that happened last night was there was someone who walked in here and said, "Oh my goodness, how on earth?" I was wondering if there could ever be a direct correlation between sound and light. How is this possible?
Yeah, and well, that's something that lots of people are very interested in the work, and they're really, I mean, it's really not possible, and especially with, say, like converting a guitar, there's no way it can go one for one. So it has to have this kind of weirdness. It has to have, it's not quite a kind of direct conversion of, say, like digital compartmentalized information into, you know, like Morse code or something like that. It's not quite like that, because there's, of course, probably gonna pronounce it wrong, but tom and things like that in sound and in chords and, you know, exact timing and things like that. It can't be just sort of converted directly.
So how have you worked out a schema for the conversion?
It's 8 channels, so it's 8 lights. That can be extended nearly infinitely, actually, just on the program up until like something like, well, infinitely, it's like 72 channels, I think, is the max that it's set to do on the program. But that then divides the frequencies into sort of like gates, so between sort of 0 and a certain number, and then 0 and then a certain number. Of course, there's certain frequencies that it just won't pick up on. It's way too high pitched or low pitched. And depending on its tuning, it will be kind of more sensitive or less sensitive to certain frequencies.
In previous installations of Infinity of Wind Muskets, have you made decisions about the placement of the lights? Because I know that one end of the room is kind of for the bass strings seem to set one side of the room.
Yeah, I don't really have that planned. But yeah, so it kind of, to a degree, there's got to be a kind of casualness in its installation. Sorry.
There were a few people in here last night that were trying to work out what string doing what, like that was their problem.
But that's the thing, because it's sort of, say, if you hit one string, that'll produce eventually they'll produce Breakers History. So yeah,
they found that the lowest string was the most regular at doing what they
were
doing.
Yeah.
And they'd always get exactly what they wanted out of it.
Yeah.
The others fluctuated. Were kind of unreliable.
That has sort of as much as well to do with its exact tuning. Because of course there's two tone knobs there on the guitar, the volume on that, the gain on the amp, and things like that. It's a lot of variables, and let it be known I'm not a sound engineer, so it's kind of like I know how to work it to a degree, but it's not something that I can kind of pinpoint for people or create a situation where it could be pinpointed.
So what's it picking up on at the moment?
That's actually a little bit of us talking, but that's kind of equivalent to amp feedback, that kind of buzzing that you get in the electrical hum, which is almost impossible to eradicate, but it's quite convenient because it kind of keeps the space a little bit buoyant in with light.
It's quite crazy though to think that you can just walk down the hallway here and a vibration that's like 20 metres away or 10 metres away can actually make those strings vibrate enough for the
enough,
to go. Because you think if your guitar's just sitting at home and it's not making any sound, you think it's really inactive.
Yeah.
But it's actually active quite
I mean, in one thing that someone once said to me about this work, which I think is very true, is although it's kind of theatrical, it's actually kind of revealing something that's really true about the space, you know, in terms of the fact that, well, even from the subatomic level upwards, that everything is in movement in a certain way. And it's actually, well, I guess, the stillness that we kind of perceive is actually an illusion. And it's actually probably the most important thing about its tuning is how much the floor moves and how the floor sends vibrations around, even more so than people's voices or anything. It's the vibration of the building. When it was in Melbourne, it was pretty good at picking up trams going past one space it was in, because they kind of really thunder whenever they go past anything.
Mm.
The immediate buildings around it really, you can just feel it go through. And there's actually a way of tuning out all everything else. It would just pick up this kind of flash when the trams went past.
How confident are people when they come and
did,
I know I saw kids playing last night, but do people pick it up and
play
with it?
They kind of touch it without picking it up. I watched it on the camera.
Yeah, that's the most
common
response.
They'll come in and I think they touch, they kind of look around because you don't know if you're supposed to touch it.
Yeah.
But it's a guitar, so
yeah.
I don't know.
Normally those things just sort of work themselves out, that people, or it spreads by word of mouth, which I kind of don't really mind so much, you know. That it exists in that kind of way.
Yeah, so you never thought of putting up some kind of indication, like touch the guitar?
Yeah, kind of can do and can't do. I think it just works out anyway.
Yeah.
I think on the last time I was installed, it had something, just a little line underneath the sign which said, like, please feel free to play the guitar, touch the guitar. But in the end, people kind of roughly negotiate it, or if they're confident musicians, they will play it, or if not, they'll kind of touch the strings.
Was that your intention?
Yeah. And I mean, as I think probably the hardest thing in showing this work is working out all the little variables of people and kind of tuning that in a way, and that it's sort of like to direct people to not direct people in their interaction with it. So it's somewhere sort of in between directed and undirected.
That
was a bright one. Must have said directed.
Someone asked a question earlier today about the lamps, because halogen can be such a difficult thing that just decides to blow.
Yeah.
And they were quite amazed that you could have such an inconstant or inconsistent
impulses. They're pretty good
without
them
blowing.
Yeah.
Did you have to alter them or do anything?
No, the whole history of the work, only one time the light has actually gone. They're exactly the same filaments as when it's been shown previously. In a way, I use them because they are variable in that way. It would have been probably quite nice to use neons or fluoros or something like that, but it does, you can't get a level of variability in my Lots of people ask about colour as well, but that again is just another sort of axis of variables and of attributation that not only do I pretty much not use any colour in my work at all, it would be another too random a variable to introduce.
So in relation to maybe earlier works, what changed or, you know, altered and led you to develop this work? And then maybe you could tell us a bit more about what you've been working on more recently.
Sure. I don't know if anything particularly changed too much with this work. I mean, I've certainly never done something as technically complex. Probably like my craft skills lie more in kind of carpentry and fabrication, things like that. But certainly, yeah, producing something that requires a body of technology was very different and difficult. But yeah, I don't think it stands outside of, say, my practice, which involves more text or things like that. It still relates to a kind of experiential opening up of the space, but without being sort of overly obsessed with the primacy of visual mechanisms of light or anything like that, in a kind of James Turrell kind of pure light way. So yeah, I mean, I think in the few works before this, one was a hallucinogenic gas of homeopathic level of mescaline given off by this kind of piece of furniture in the room, which it is again sort of experiential and kind of alchemical.
So what, people walked into a room and there was a piece of furniture that had
like a hallucinogenic, yeah, like a humidifier giving off it. Only homeopathic level.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's kind of, but again, I guess it's this thing of altered state as well, of dealing with things that are in an altered state. What's been working on recently? Recently, well, I guess we have here the little kind of holographic diamond kind of thing that is origami that comes out of the magazine. There's a magazine from Melbourne called Unmagazine, and there's an insert in it, in this recent issue, which is a work of mine, which is a kind of very complicated and doesn't actually look at all the same from any angle shape, which folds up and folds into this sort of twisted diamond where the two points are facing opposite each other. And I think, again, that has kind of a similar relationship to this work in terms of alchemy and channeling and something sort of coming up out of something or blooming out of something. But I also kind of really liked it because it was an opportunity to do a work in a magazine that wasn't an image of a work or something, that it sort of reversed that kind of mode of works being kind of being able to be photographed and then experienced through photographs. It was actually a work that a sculpture that actually came up out of the actual magazine itself.
I mean, we've already had a few conversations about, you know, documentation in terms of a traditional mode that the physics room would follow, sort of for our archive or for future use. And I guess that's a really nice parallel, and it's really great that the UN magazine's here for, you know, people to have a look at and see.
Mm.
Because
you,
I think, yeah, we'll hand them out afterwards. There is a handout. Because I think it's an issue that a lot of work doesn't negotiate in a kind of knowing way.
Yeah.
Maybe,
I mean,
like
a whole
an unwitting slippage in terms of a work's effect, and then it's the effect that it has in reproduction.
Yeah, well, I think it's very interesting that you can experience works through their reproduction, but it's kind of also part of what probably could call, although this is coming from a slightly different angle, is like an invisible design structure of the experience of art. That's kind of stolen from Bruce Mao, the idea of invisible design structures being invisible, so sort of you know, meat packing and the whole thing. So we just don't see it. That's what design structures do. And there's actually kind of this invisibility to how art operates that can kind of be broken open somehow or activated, sort of when paying attention to when and where, you know, the actual experience of the work takes place. I mean, particularly in Australia and New Zealand, of course, as well, because most of the work that people live by and grow up by and develop their whole practices on and things like that, they've never actually seen. And, you know, it's only, say, photographic reproductions of thinking particularly of, like, the large glass that, you know, I didn't know anyone that actually seen it, but everyone kind of knew it intricately through this kind of study process of all its, you know, various...
The bottom of the world, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Well, yeah, yeah. But it's kind of an interesting thing how, you know, you can really... I mean, everyone down here has huge experiences, bodies of work that have never even been here, that have never... have never actually been seen with the naked eye on it.
In terms of your personal kind of biography of growing up in the UK and then coming out, I mean, maybe that's, you know, that's obviously more apparent because of distance. I mean,
yeah.
I think it's one of those invisible structures that you kind of get used to and you don't really
know that you're functioning at a deficit. Yeah, no, absolutely,
yeah.
I mean, not that I think it's really a bad thing, but that may well.
Yeah, it's just kind of another lens or present or something to a cultural location.
Yeah.
Or dislocation, maybe.
Yeah, yeah.
Did you have, any other options in terms of the input for the work? I mean, you've used a guitar, but you could have used other things, right?
Yeah.
What made you settle on a guitar?
Kind of because they almost have, like, the vibration of the strings and things has this almost like, I don't know, it's sort of very liquid, as opposed to, I mean, I would love to do it with piano, but actually...
I was wondering what it would be like if we opened
it
last night.
Yeah, I know, that would be great. That would be fantastic. I mean, you could do it with a really good with a keyboard, because you just wouldn't actually, you wouldn't hear any sound at all. But I think it was only ever going to be either a piano or a keyboard. And I possibly got other works planned for pianos.
Ah, very good.
So the guitar at the time was the most appropriate with the idea of the strings and the vibration and things like that equating into the space.
Could you talk about wind muskets?
A little bit, yeah.
Okay, off we go.
That was a kind of really oblique piece of philosophical poetry that Gottfried Leibniz mentioned in a letter once to, obviously forget who it was to, no one of particular importance, but, or probably in some genres, but not to other means here. And I thought it was just a really fantastic, like a bleak poetic way of describing it. It actually describes it, or it's the kind of end to a sentence that's talking about the relationship between animate and inanimate matter and kind of something coming to life. Like, so I guess it's kind of mystical. And in a way kind of confusing as an endpoint, you know, it's not a piece of language that's obviously designed to be decoded or something. You can't really decode the words at all to describe how this kind of Baroque philosophy of folding and interfolding actually really worked. I guess it's kind of not, it's appropriately mystical.
We were talking when Matthew was setting up about a work that was in Christchurch, I think in 2002, as part of Scape. It was by a musician who lives in Christchurch called Christopher Cree Brown. It was an Aeolian harp. I'm not sure if any of you saw it, but yeah, it was a wind harp. And it was set up on the Archer's Lawn in the Botanic Gardens for the duration of the Arts Festival. And I guess, you know, a wind-blown harp, the music or the sound of which was produced, it was an interesting thing to be thinking about in terms of people's understanding of the way in which different kinds of, impulse or movement in music can kind of harness something that's happening anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Wind's kind of appropriate in that way. It's pretty mysterious stuff. Where does it go when it's not blowing? But yeah, I mean, I think that's a very different work in terms of its considerations and so on, but yeah.
But I guess just in terms of the kind of the ethereal sort of things that sort of are mobilised by this work, in terms of the recent history of kind of practice here in Christchurch, it is, I don't know, it kind of sits a little to one side of experience within art galleries at least.
Yeah.
Which is really nice. I think it's a really refreshing thing.
Yeah, it's kind of difficult making work with musical instruments when you're not a musician, because we've spoken about that. There's a certain established kind of genre of artist-musician, which is fine. But yeah, I'm certainly not that. I mean, probably most recently I've been working with the design of posters, but I'm not a graphic designer and so on. So yeah, I guess in a way it's a work for musicians in an art gallery, as opposed to sort of it being about me being a musician, or, you know.
I kind of think about it though, like, I'm not a musician and I have never played the guitar, but we got a little bit obsessed with the recent games that have come out with guitars and drums and stuff like
that. Yeah,
so
I think that looks like an unfortunate release at the same time.
Get
the
beat right and all this sort of stuff, and so to me it's kind of like a bit of a game, like you want to play the guitar so you get the best kind of like big, you know, how you see those music videos with the stack of Marshalls behind you and like all the big lights going, so you kind of want to get that effect going in here, but I can't play anything on a guitar apart from if I'm playing Rock Band or Guitar Hero. So
that's fine. I think it was an unfortunate similar time of releasing of Rock Band and Guitar Hero with this coincided.
Like, it's just kind of probably completely not even on the point of
it was in the paper in Melbourne, and it was like the headline was like Guitar Hero something something. I didn't really want that.
But it's one of those things that you can't know. No one knew that there was going to be this new game
Craze
where we all pretend we were.
If only I had known.
Then you would have,
Piano Hero.
Take
that
piano.
No, bring
that
DJ Hero. Thanks.
No.
That's my custom DJ
deal.
But I actually find those games really frustrating because of the requirement to actually get
it's very
right.
Competitive.
Yeah.
I'm good at the guitar, not the drum.
I always end up doing the singing whenever I play that, which is like the whole thing.
Singer's good at the singing.
That so much value can be put on precision and no points for creativity doesn't really. You were talking about sort of stadium rock before in the more formal part of this talk earlier on. What's been, a powerful experience for you going to concerts and large venues?
I don't really think I've ever been to a concert like that. I've certainly never been to a U2 concert where there's like... I don't know, probably am to quite a large degree influenced by the experience of... dance music culture and raves and things like that, but that much more than because you're not really watching anyone in there's no economy of performance in those, as opposed to the U2 huge concert stadium with like a big floating robot or something like that that has flames coming out of its eyes and, I'd without a doubt I'd be far more influenced by the performance of electronic music. And there is a performer there, but it's kind of not really the most interesting thing at the time. It's more sort of about the... It becomes really more like furniture than music in those situations too. It sort of furnishes your interactions that you're actually having in the space. But I haven't done that for a couple of years.
Furniture, I mean... I hadn't really thought about it in those terms, but I mean,
furniture furnishes a situation.
Yeah,
that's one of my bullet points that I bring out to people. But you can work with the furniture to create a situation as opposed to having to work in them. Sort of orchestrating people's interactions kind of way in a criteria release or something like that kind of way.
Because furniture always has a purpose. There's always a correct way to sit on a chair. To turn it upside down defeats the purpose, but it doesn't make it any less valid in the room.
No. A bit less valid on your hips.
Yeah. Not so good for spine.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think furniture is really interesting in terms of how it does work in gallery spaces and things like that.
So have you done installation work outside of gallery spaces?
No. Yeah, no. It's probably something that I would certainly like to do more of. But it's actually it's a reasonably hard area to sort of convert my practice into.
Yeah, because it seems like...
I think it's kind of actually the thing I'd like to do in the future more of.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
I like the fact that the guest work as well.
Yeah.
And you just become really aware of that small stuff, especially in like a sanitary environment.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like it makes you aware of everything, which would become overly complex if it was out of the gallery.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think it's still appropriate for most of my works to be in gallery context, but they sort of can exist outside of them.
Mm-hmm.
There's one work I made which was kind of a sort of inverted piece of archaeology in that it was a sculpture to be buried, and it was buried. So I guess that was kind of outside of the gallery context, but it was shown in the gallery and then was taken to a secret forest location and buried.
And I'll dig it up in 100 years.
Well, yeah, but it's just that someone would dig it up, and then all of a sudden it's almost like a communication through time or something, in the way in which archaeology is, and that, you know, you sort of physically hold an object that somebody dropped there. It's obviously been under geological environmental pressures, but so it's a strange way of communicating like a pure signal across huge amounts of time.
Mm. Last night you were talking about growing up in and around the pits of a museum.
Oh yeah, yeah.
So archaeology in those kinds of...
Definitely an interest in archaeology. I've always had an interest in archaeology, yeah. There's a big museum in Oxford that's just a huge collection. In fact, I even went to the Christchurch Museum this afternoon.
How did you find that?
Because I went to the gallery and then just...
Not physically, I mean, how did you find the experience?
Oh, right. I sort of just wandered east, I think, and then just ended up there. I thought it was interesting that there was still a use of sort of wax model type scenes.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I've seen that for quite a while, but that was good. There's lots of interesting things there. I thought it was interesting there was one room where obviously the first museum that had been set up, they wanted to sort of have copies of the artifacts from the British Museum, like the Rosetta Stone and like sort of Egyptian obelisks and things that were obviously seen as important things to sort of be able to physically see and experience, so they made copies of them. I don't think I've ever seen that before. I think that's probably the most interesting thing, is the fake Rosetta Stone that they've got there. But other than that, a lot of the other stuff in there was very interesting.
I guess because we've sort of been talking about how work can find appropriate placement outside of institutions, it's good to also kind of be aware that things like museums, although they're everywhere, still have, you know, very precise nuances about them in terms of presentation and display. And the kinds of codes that they employ.
I was going to say, yeah, it's entirely codified,
mm-hmm.
Kind of thing.
Some of which is often convenience.
Of course, yeah. But yeah, I guess, I mean, there's also a large degree of my practice that kind of, this is why I think it's appropriate for other spaces other than galleries, because galleries do kind of have a similar kind of code to museums to a degree. And it's that kind of breaking it up and making things more like garden-like, where things can interact. I think statuary is a really interesting thing, which is just kind of sort of in formal 17th and 18th century gardens. And the statues aren't the focus, but they're just sort of parts of an experiential interacting space. that, you know,
which often kind of populate but also point to certain elements that should
should
be paid attention to.
Yeah, in a way. I mean, I always think it's just it's a kind of a different type of structure. And I think in even a way, even when my works are in galleries, they're kind of like statuaries, even if they are kind of active in a way that's not just making them kind of decorative.
I wanted to ask you a question about how your interest in experience translates to more event-based understandings of kind of cultural experience these days.
What kind of event-based stuff do you
mean?
I
don't know. Just earlier on, you were talking about kind of temporality and the things that kind of go on within certain delimited periods of time, i.e., the exhibition.
Yes.
And I guess, you know, could this work function in a space of less than 4 weeks? Could it just be a day? Could it?
Yeah. No. Absolutely. Yeah. I think playing around with that kind of temporality is very interesting, and very probably pointing to my practice.
Because I think a lot of artists don't necessarily, or maybe they have a certain kind of approach to the opening night versus the run of an exhibition.
Yeah.
And I think the experience that we all had last night of a lot of small children who came to the opening interacting gleefully with
and
the
even
work.
Trying to get into that box.
Changes the exhibition.
Just trying to reprogram it.
Yeah. And they kill themselves, I don't know what's going on there. I often come to the conclusion that I actually would, to a degree, prefer there wasn't an opening to my work.
Mm-hmm.
Because, in a way, particularly every single show I've done this year, it's activated the space in a certain way that's not necessarily appropriate for an opening, or it means that I have to factor in that as well in sort of part of its design.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly the, as I was describing a work to you, I think you did yesterday or the day before, that was a kind of a op art blanket, a plastic and vinyl blanket that was inside a gallery, probably about the same size as this, but square. There was the roofs, the floor, the walls, everything, and kind of almost went through one of those butcher curtain kind of things and into it. And when there was an opening, that was just a nightmare because, of course, somebody went in a wheelchair. And I just thought, oh no, I really don't want it to fall down now, because it's just like physicalities of space and people and everything. It's something that actually requires a lot of consideration and design to make sure it's going to both last the opening amount of people and the requirements and things like that on that, and actually what it's kind of, how it's envisaged with sort of low level traffic kind of going through it. It also means I have to consider public safety a lot more with these things. But I guess that's how it is kind of, that's almost like a proof of it connecting with, the works connecting with these kind of issues of space and experience and numbers of people and everything.
It works quite differently with less people in here, because it's so quiet as well.
I think when more people in here, it kind of becomes like a rock stadium thing.
Yeah.
And less people in here, it becomes like either that, some sort of avant-garde turn light show, music turned into an avant-garde, they turn the light show, all that. Close Encounters of a Third Kind, is, you know, that light bulb, which I think is fantastic, I think. But yeah, it's completely different, and yeah, I think it doesn't, I don't like it as much when it comes to people.
There's this article, The Experience Economy, that was something like, Harvard Business
Review. Oh, yeah, yeah.
And they talk about, you know, the importance of all five senses.
Yeah.
And it's really nice that there's no sound, so you do become aware of the.
Yeah.
That it's like a real experience, but there's something so huge missing from it.
I'm just surprised. I think it has to do with like an invisible design structure of sort of experience in painting, is that it's never referred to, it's always referred to as much more experiential than conceptual work, when actually all it's engaging is like the visual and cerebral kind of mechanism. So to me sometimes I feel like Mark Rothko paintings are more conceptual than so much other work.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, it just doesn't seem that way. But yeah, experience economy, I think, is a really very interesting thing.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about, in terms of the work, like, giving you back something that you know, when you
play,
you said last night that it's always going to be quite different to how you program it. You never program it to have, like, you know, exact lights going off.
Well, yeah, I guess that's kind of a thing of the work being open and existing, in that people have different experiences of it and then kind of talk about them. So it's almost like there is a degree of unique experience within
mm-hmm.
Within the work. I guess, to a, you know, in another way you get that with all works, but almost in a physical sense that you experience something different
mm-hmm.
or near to different every time.
Can you maybe say something about whether that sort of, I don't know, DIY or that kind of catalyst, like catalyzing presence or participant functions across maybe other works too? Because I was thinking in relation to the page work in Un magazine.
Yeah.
You know, it functions on the page only so long as someone's
there's
bold enough to
bold
cut it out.
Cut it out. Yeah, it's quite time consuming.
Same thing here.
I think, I don't know, maybe it's just something about how the works tend to operate. It's not something I've really got a defined position on, but it's almost like, I think it must come from considering the input from the viewer on a level playing field to sort of every other factor, that not, it's not as if that's raised above necessarily in terms of like a sort of a horizon of the work is the interaction with the viewer, and then that's it. It's just that somehow the viewers are kind of in the are on a level playing field with you know, other elements in the work.
But I guess a certain degree of amplification happens.
Oh yeah, certainly. Yeah, certainly.
Which is interesting, because when you think about it, if you think about painting, you know, that Rothko's still humming on the wall, even if no one's there looking at it.
Well, that's it. But I guess with my works, it's sort of like the fridge light door or something. It's like the fridge light's still on with the Rothko, even if no one's looking at it. But yeah, the view, you need to kind of peek, the view is to open the door so you get the light.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
Beautiful, thank you. Yeah. That'll follow you around for
kitchen
a while.
Kitchen metaphors, they're like kitchen-based metaphors.
Had you done any kind of other page work before? I mean, you were talking about making posters.
I've done works that are... I've done a couple of postcards.
That were designed to employ that circulation that a postcard's supposed to have?
Well, yeah, I actually just think of those, the project that was the buried sculpture, there's a sort of a catering kind of company, cafe and things that's connected to Gertrude Street, and they produce these postcards of all our work, all the time, seemingly, but, which is really good. But normally those are then images of people's works, just represented in that way.
And so you subverted that work?
Well, yeah, I've done a couple. I actually did one that was a similar one to the sort of fold-out sculpture. It was kind of an architectural kind of thing.
What's the fold-out page called?
White Hologram.
White Hologram.
Yeah. But yeah, there was one time with those postcards, it was basically a computer line drawing, a sort of computer line rendering, white lines and black background of the sculpture that had been buried. So it was as if, you know, the work itself is sort of gone into this communication with the time, space and the future, but it was sort of living on in the present in another sense, and is that, you know, people would pick them up and kind of know, it sort of vaguely jolt a memory of something they'd seen. And so yeah, it was kind of, I guess, interacting with the memory of the work without kind of representing it. It sort of requires, sort of jolted the actual physical memory experience. I've also done invites. I've done quite a few invites for a show called Spooky Activity Around Midnight, which it's not a show that has any works or ever going to exist. So it's just this, it's kind of how, you know, trailers and things like that announce experiences that are to come. And again, I guess engaging the mechanism of getting an invite going, and that represents somehow a connection to going to an event, that kind of thing. Even that it's sort of opening up a silence an event, that there's no event or anything, it's just this...
Is it because there's no event or the event keeps slipping over the horizon?
Possibly, yeah, possibly. So it exists in that present moment of something future coming, but things never really come because it's not a real show.
I think the Bruce Mann when he talks about, I think I read those quotes as well, about the plane crash.
About what, sorry?
The plane crash quote, where he talks about, you know, you take off but you're unaware of the plane.
Oh yeah, absolutely, yeah.
And it's kind of linked back to that experience that is yet to come, like,
yeah.
You're aware of this possibility of this, you know.
Yeah. And we engage with those kind of experiences all the time. It's just they're not sort of quite activated in lots of people's work or something. But yeah.
Yeah.
I think probably Jean-Luc Godard in his films really did activate those things of something to come throughout the entire thing. People sort of don't like it because of various things, but yeah, it is like an experience that we have all the time, and it's just not always focused or given prominent credence or something.
Sounds like that's about it.
Probably
we should say thank you and hope that you have a safe trip home
thank
on
you
the plane
much.
That will hopefully not crash.
Or, yeah. If he does, whatever, I'll probably be asleep.
Yeah,
so it's
fine.
Cool. Thanks all for coming as well.